love doing that. Good evening. Welcome to the program on the green economy brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. I'm Brian Goncher, Director of U.S. Clean Tech for Deloitte and a proud sponsor of tonight's programs. I have the honor of introducing tonight's panel, and let me start with Parag Chokshi. He is the, thank you, Parag, the Clean Energy Public Affairs Manager at Google, where the company has invested probably more than $1 billion now in clean energy projects from solar and wind farms to clean tech startups around the world. He was the Oregon Press Secretary for Obama for America in 2008 and also worked at Distributed World Power and is a graduate of Georgetown University. Welcome, Parag. Josh, thank you. Josh Green, he's part of More David Dow Ventures and joined their clean tech team in 2006. For the past 25 years, he's helped more than 150 companies, you're understating it probably, Josh, through success in their IPOs and their life, and currently works with a wide range of startups from lithium products and biochemicals to LED lighting. Josh graduated from UCLA and the UCLA School of Law and is chairman and co-founder of the UCLA Venture Capital Fund with Ron Conway. Congratulations, Josh. Next is Linda Chiella. Did I get that right, Linda?
That's good.
Excellent. Is the Vice President of Human Resources at SolarCity, the leading solar company in the United States, serving 30,000 customers in 14 states. With more than 200 years, Linda, you're not that old. 20 years of strategic business experience, Linda was co-founder and vice president of Transform Blue, which is a mobile internet technology company, and was vice president of business operations and corporate secretary at NBX, and executive vice president and chief people officer at US Web CKS. I remember it well. That was a wonderful company. Welcome, Linda. Last but not least is Nancy Klein. She's deputy director of the Office of Economic Development for the City of San Jose, and is in charge of implementing their green vision. It's a bold 15-year plan to create 25,000 clean tech jobs, build or retrofit 50 million square feet of green buildings, and move the city to 100% renewable energy. You have a big job, Nancy. Mm-hmm. Nancy has more than 15 years of economic development experience and worked for the City of San Leandro and the San Jose Redevelopment Agency. And finally, our moderator for this evening, Allison Van Diggelen, is the host of the Fresh Dialogues interview series and is a former columnist at the San Jose Mercury News and a contributor to KQED's California Report and the Climate Watch. Allison, please take it away.
Thank you, Brian. This evening, we're going to address the question, where are the opportunities in the green economy? And I've picked this panel because I want to give the audience here in Silicon Valley and the audience listening on the radio a good variety of perspectives on the green economy. We have the venture capitalist perspective from Josh Green next to me here. We have the policymaker, Klein. We have the corporate leader's perspective from Parag. And we have the green job maker's perspective from Linda Chiella. So first, so that we're all on the same page, I'd like to start by thinking about definitions. What is the definition of the green economy, clean tech and green jobs? And I think we have Mr. Green with us, Josh Green. I think he's well qualified to answer that question. Josh.
Well, thanks, Allison. I honestly did not change my name when I started investing in clean technologies as an added advantage, but I'll take advantage of it. The way I define clean tech is that it is the application of technology, or it can be services, that will unlock value in either the creation of energy or the use of the energy. And I look at it as creating greater efficiency, greater productivity, greater accessibility to energy by more people. Now, that doesn't sound – you notice there wasn't – I didn't use the word green in there at all, and that was quite intentional. It actually is the productivity, the creation of productivity on both sides of the equation, both demand as well as the
– Great. Thank you for that. So, Nancy Klein, San Jose City has a very bold green vision to create 25,000 jobs by 2022. And the city claims to have created 8,000 green jobs. Can you describe to us your definition of green jobs?
Yes, I'm very happy to say, excuse me, that it's very close to Josh's.
we try to take a very pragmatic approach that it's a good or a service that creates an efficiency that meets environmental goals. And it's not as easy to track as the sound of it, because we don't, in fact, have a window into large corporations, say, of a Google or a Cisco, who can't extract out what that job generation is. So our 7,000 to 8,000 job number is a conservative one. But looking across the sectors, as Josh mentioned, thinking about the service end of it as well in finance, because that's very important to clean tech, green tech. But the many sectors that contribute in energy efficiency, solar being a primary, building efficiencies, the finance, as we said, even in agriculture. So there's a wide array of spectrum or sectors, but we try to keep the definition pretty succinct.
Great. Now, Parag, you manage the public affairs for Google's sustainability program. Can you give for us a description of what green means to Google and why Google has invested almost $1 billion in clean energy projects?
Sure. You know, we look at clean energy and sustainability both as a corporate value and as a business opportunity. And so for us, you know, it's a lot of people ask, you know, why is a search engine involved in clean tech? And the fact is that, like any company in America, energy drives our business. It's critical to our infrastructure, our data center infrastructure. And so we want that energy to be as clean as possible. But we also think there's a great business opportunity, both in terms of efficiency and productivity. And we want to see the sector grow, and we've done, I think you can think about the work that we do in two ways. The first is, how do we make Google more efficient, more sustainable? And then how can we catalyze further and spur growth in the industry? And we've done a lot of things in both of those categories, and that's kind of how we view being a green company.
Great. Now, Linda Kiala, your company, Solar City, is riding the green wave of solar. We hear a lot about doom and gloom solar, Solyndra, which we'll get into later. But your company is expanding fast in the Bay Area. I understand you're hiring about 4 new employees a day nationally and about 10 a month in the Bay Area. Can you talk about that growth and what is spurring that growth?
I can't talk a lot about forward-looking growth for the company. I think most of you probably have read that we have done a confidential filing with the SEC looking towards a IPO at some point. So I can't give forward-looking statements and things like that, and I apologize, so some of my questions might be a bit limited today. But what I can tell you about is more the things that have happened recently in the company and the growth. When I started with SolarCity, which was about 2 years ago, when I was interviewing with the company, we had about 500 or 600 employees. We have over 2,000 employees today. We've added 600 employees this year alone, just since January. So we've seen some amazing growth in our company. We've kind of gone the opposite way of Solyndra and all that. You said you're going to talk about that later on, so we can get more into that if you want. But we've been flourishing and doing really well.
Great. Good. Now, I'd like the panel to help us understand the role of the ecosystem and the infrastructure, government policy on national, state, and local level. I want to start with you, Josh. Can you put things into context for us? Why is it that Silicon Valley and the Bay Area is such a hotbed for clean tech innovation and clean tech manufacturing?
Okay, I can certainly do that. If you want to talk about the policy aspects, I can go into that as well. But starting where, I mean, I think I said this out in the hallway before we started, and that is Mecca is Mecca. This is the center of technology and innovation, not only in the United States, but in the world at large. Everybody, I'm not saying and telling anybody any news by this, but saying that this is where the ecosystem that has been developed. I've been in the Valley for 32 years. I have seen the elements of the ecosystem develop to a point now where it is very much turnkey, where someone can come in from anywhere in the world and instantly have access to the best lawyers who want to work with the two guys or two gals, a computer, and a dog. all at the same time to found the next great startup. And they have everything around them. They have lawyers, they have accountants, they have investors, they have space where they can go into, and everybody understands that language. And actually, this is one of the environments, and maybe one of the only ones, where it's actually turned upside down. It's seen as the cool thing is to be in the small company, not in the big company. There is an ancient thing around here known as the Taj Mahal complex. You know, when a company gets its Taj Mahal, that's the time to move to a small company. Again, so that's that may cause some short-term heartaches for large companies, but it is incredibly renewing, and it creates an environment that continues to thrive now in the clean technology sector. So it was perfect to put that in. One last comment about clean technology, and that is that we do not have an entrepreneurial base to look to. In my firm, when we say, well, we're really interested in investing in multiple the successful clean tech entrepreneurs, the answer is there are none, okay? It just hasn't been around that long to create multiple generations of success there. So instead, what we like to look at is an entrepreneurial cocktail, which is usually a domain expert, someone coming from a large company who seeks to create some innovation, and marrying that person up with an entrepreneur, somebody who's coming from the entrepreneurial segments of Silicon Valley, usually in the information technology arena, sometimes in the biotech arena, and then marrying that entrepreneur up with that domain expert to then go and exploit that idea and that opportunity that they have.
Great. Well, we'll come back to the national policy and whatnot. Let's go to you, Nancy. Talk about what the city of San Jose is doing as far as creating the right ecosystem and infrastructure for clean tech.
Thank you. There are several things. First of all is to get out of the way to make sure that we don't cause policy or demands that are going to inhibit activity and innovation. And then we work very much on the demand side as well as the supply side. So, and we're very, very aware of how we can put forward a building code or a green vision that will stimulate opportunity into the marketplace. For example, we created just putting into place a brand new commercial waste program, which is by far the largest in the country. And as part of that, the contract to put the trucks in place to haul that is a longer time frame, and we require that a certain amount of them be electric. So that is by using the heft of our purchasing capacity and our contract capacity. So we will, on the demand side, spur innovation. On the supply side, we work very hard with the incentive programs that we have, and also what we came to find out after hundreds of conversations, literally, how important demonstration is. So the first thing that we did was create a demonstration policy so that all the city's land and buildings can be used by entrepreneurs to demonstrate their technology. And then beyond that, and perhaps later we talk a little bit about, we're just about or embarking on something called Prospect Silicon Valley, which is a demonstration center, which will have shared lab space, which will have demonstration space so that companies can come in and show and tinker, talk to their first clients, talk to their investors, work with Lawrence Berkeley National Labs, which is a major partner, or Stanford, and in technology transfer. So accelerating commercialization is something we're very committed to.
Right. And Josh, we talked earlier about an innovation tax credit that you're working on. Can you describe what you're proposing on that in the context of national policy
to stimulate very tech? Quickly, I'll give you a little bit of background. I do a lot. Well, first of all, energy is the most heavily regulated human activity. Now, I say that and you're probably thinking out there, no, healthcare is. I hear so much about the healthcare debate and all the rest of it. The answer is actually no. It is actually energy. And that's true not only in the United States, it's true in every country around the globe. The United States is the largest country without a coherent national energy policy. But nonetheless, energy is heavily, heavily regulated. So about a year ago, I became very tired of playing defense with respect to clean energy and the national policy with respect to clean tech. And as a result, one of my colleagues, Will Coleman, and I came up with the idea of an energy innovation tax credit. And what this proposal would be, which Will has subsequently testified on both the Senate and the House side, is that it would take an industry which, and this is an amazing statistic, but spends 0.4% of its revenues on research and development. 0.4%. And for those of you here in Silicon Valley, you know that the average company here spends over 10% of its revenues on R&D. So in order to encourage that number to get to something that was more reasonable and rational, as well as to eliminate the unfair playing field that exists with the amount of fossil fuel subsidies that are out there versus renewable subsidies, it was to go to a innovation tax credit that would not declare winners or losers. It would actually not discern between fossil fuels or renewables, for that matter. It would simply incentivize innovation. And as a result of that, it would say that you get a tax credit when you come up with a technology innovation until such time as X number of gallons or Y number of electrons, depending on the industry it was created in, would be produced and you would actually be commercialized. So it would get people across, for those who know this term, the valley of death, mm-hmm. which is the creation of the demonstration facility, the creation of the first commercial plant, and really get innovations into the marketplace so that they could compete with historic uses of technology and the rest that have not been updated for decades on a much more even playing field. We're very happy that at this point it looks like we haven't introduced the legislation yet. It is going to be supported bipartisanly in the House. I know that's a statement that no one can believe, but and we'll see it when I see it.
Statement.
When
yeah.
I see it, we'll believe it. But that's what we're told, as well as bipartisan support in the Senate. We think it will ultimately get rolled up into the national debate on tax reform that will happen probably next year sometime.
Well, I think we all wish you well with that, Josh. Bipartisan support. So Parag Chokshi from Google, I'd like you to talk about the impact of national and state policy on Google's investments, and also talk about Google's impact on public debate. Last year, Google published a report, The Impact of Clean Energy Innovation. And it was something I wrote about and studied and called it Google's Green Dream. And it was all about if all this innovation happened and if the investment came into clean tech, then here's what we could do for the economy and for the environment. So if you could talk a little on these two points, that would be great.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, I think there's not enough funding being put towards new technologies, and there's a real opportunity. I think the EIA has estimated that over the next two decades, the world is going to spend $26 trillion to develop, you know, the energy technologies, the generation that we need to meet global demand. So that's a big number, and there are a lot of opportunities for this country. To take advantage of some of those opportunities. And so we need, I think, public policy, national policy, state policy is critical. And Google has been supportive, at the state level and the national level. And that's actually part of the reason that we put out that report. There hasn't been a lot of good data about the impact of policy. And in fact, there hasn't been a lot of data comparing the subsidies that go towards fossil fuels versus what's in place. There's a lot of talk about Solyndra, but not a lot of talk about really what is the playing field. And so that report was an attempt to look over the long term, 20 years, 30 years, and see if we were to put in place a set of policies, what impact would that have on wind generation, solar generation, our electricity mix, but also EV penetration. And it's obviously there's a big fudge factor when you're looking that far ahead. But we found, some pretty dramatic results that we can really speed up innovation and speed up the transition towards a clean energy economy by putting a national clean energy policy in place. And in terms of Google, what we've done so far, a lot of policy has really enabled us to invest.
Can you talk about specific policies that helped you invest?
Sure. You know, there's the tax credits that are involved with renewable energy investment, and we've invested over $900 million in the clean tech sector, and that's helped spur our investments. And we're looking to see other companies invest as well. Google, unfortunately, is the only corporate that's not an energy company, not a bank, that's doing these types of investments, tax equity investments in clean energy projects. And we're encouraging other companies. In fact, here in Silicon Valley, there are lots of companies that have cash that could invest. And there are some challenges. I think you have to get comfortable with the technologies, and that took us a while to do. But there are some great incentives in place right now, actually, that companies can take advantage of and earn great returns and, of course, spur further development. So it's helped us put the money that we've invested into the sector. And we're hopeful that, you know, there are some challenges. As many of you know, the production tax credit is ending at the end of this year. So there are some challenges in place. But I think, you know, if we can develop a national policy, probably not until after the election, I think we can really take advantage of this, of the growth in this industry.
So you're feeling optimistic about it?
I have to feel optimistic, yeah.
He's part of the green team. So Linda Keala of SolarCity, I like your perspective going back to the ecosystem question. Why is SolarCity in the Bay Area? It's an expensive area to be. Why are you based here? Can you talk to that?
I think part of the main reason that we're based here is that the two brothers have founded the company. We're based here. Pretty typical of Silicon Valley companies where you start out in your garage. The company literally started out in the apartment of one of our founders in San Francisco, and he and his brother, Lyndon and Pete Rive, they both live here in the Bay Area. That's why we started the company here. And then we've expanded beyond California. We're now in 11, 12 states. As far west is Hawaii, and as far east is Massachusetts. I'll pick that over New York because I grew up there. So we've just expanded the company as we've seen, you know, the opportunities expand for us in different states.
All right. Is it anything to do with skilled labor? Is that a factor for SolarCity or not so much?
You know, it's actually a really good question because we went through this exercise late last year and looking at the cost of our employees and all that. And we have this little sort of running joke in the company. We actually took a trip to Boise, Idaho. And they, you know, recruited us really heavily and said, we know that you're expanding and the cost for your employees in the Bay Area must be really high. Boise is a great place. So we actually went on a trip to Boise. So every time we talk about expansion and all that, it's always going to be Boise, you know. And it was a great experience and a great place and all that. But we really have seriously looked at the cost of our employees and space in the area, you know, office space and things like that. And I think over time what we're starting to do now in the company is we're not hiring so many employees here at HQ that we can hire and locate in our field operations. And we're basically putting some of our employees in some of the roles that can have a better touch being out in the region with the regional folks that don't have to be located here. We are moving them out to our field offices and all that because it is very expensive and it is hard to compete. You know, we have a lot of jobs we'll probably get into a little bit later on, but some of the jobs that we hire for are software engineers, and that's really hard for us to compete with the Googles of the world, you know, in Silicon Valley for that kind of talent.
Right. And I promise we would get on to Solyndra. We can't really talk about clean tech right now without talking about Solyndra. So Linda, can you explain for someone that knows vaguely that Solyndra was this big solar company that failed dramatically, how can that happen where SolarCity is expanding so fast? Can you
really very
explain?
Different companies. And, you know, there's a lot that's been written about Solyndra and all that, so I don't want to offer too much commentary on there, but I can give you very simplistically the basic difference between the two. Solyndra was a panel manufacturer, panel technology company. That's not what we do. You know, we are we provide a full service of technologies, but we don't manufacture the panels. We do all the design, the installation, the maintenance, the permitting, the full service. Once you decide that you want to buy a solar system from SolarCity, we take it from there, and we do everything related to that installation and the maintenance. But we don't manufacture panels, and that's the main difference between us and Solyndra.
Great. And Josh, can you talk about this Solyndra aftermath?
Well, I always described it as I was looking for the day of the Solyndra half-life, not the end of Solyndra, because politicians will continue to utilize whatever they can to their own advantage out of the aftermath of Solyndra. The truth is that this is part of the Department of Energy Loan Guarantee Program that was and continues to be very controversial. However, that loan guarantee program, contrary to what you may have heard, is actually operating well within its loan loss reserves. In other words, it said certain loans are going to fail. It turns out Solyndra was one of those loans. It failed. That's what happens in a loan guarantee program. Not everyone is successful. I can point to another company that is highly successful with a loan guarantee. It doesn't play it up very much, but it's Tesla. Tesla has over $500 million loan guarantee, has started producing its own vehicles, which I understand from all the reviews is just a terrific car, a terrific automobile, and is a real success story. And again, the program is operating as it intended to have, it was intended to do, and now, unfortunately, the whole Solyndra mess became a big political football, which has been tossed back and forth. The good news on all this is that we passed the half-life. The Congress, about a month ago, officially stopped all of its hearings. It's over. There's not going to be any more people dragged out in front of witness tables and all the rest of it. There is – the reason I say it's a half-life is because there will be continued efforts at passing legislation to end the loan guarantee program and to go after that. But again, this is in a highly political, contentious atmosphere and the like. But Solyndra itself is it's over in terms of an issue as far as we're concerned. And as an investor, it never was an issue. It was a company that was not successful. But, you know, I've got a portfolio with lots of companies that are not successful.
It would be really interesting, Josh, for you to give us your statistics. For 100 companies you invest in, how many are successful?
Well, the old saw about venture capital is that out of 100 investments, if you have 10 that meet your investment objective, which is 10 times your money or better, then you are wildly successful. That makes you a top venture capitalist. That means you have a 90% under your expectations success rate. Now, that doesn't mean all those other 90 companies go out of business, but it does mean that some do. Some end up in what we charitably call the living dead category. They are alive, but they're not growing and all the rest of it. And some grow, but don't do this wildly aggressive number like 10x your money. They make 5x your money and the rest. And that's where the other 90 companies fall into. So, you know, that's my business. That's what we're supposed to work towards.
Great. I think that gives us a good perspective. Now, I do want to get on to tips and advice for people in the audience here and listening at home for finding and securing these green jobs and green investments. But first, I want to do an overview of the particular sectors of the green economy. We've had the definition of what green means, but I want to drill down a little and get a feel for what are the hot areas now and what might be the future hot areas. So let's start with you, Josh. We talked earlier about what areas you're excited about. You mentioned energy efficiency, LED lighting, and building management systems. Can you explain why these areas are hot and give some examples of particular companies that you're excited about?
Sure. Basically, and this is true of the venture investment category more generally in clean technology, so I'm not alone in feeling this way. In the current environment, we're looking for less capital-intensive deals. So that means that we are on the side of energy demand much more than energy production, because energy production takes more capital intensity. So when you're on that side, some of the categories that Allison just mentioned are, in fact, the areas of focus and interest for us. Sometimes people call this clean tech IT, or stated otherwise, a really information technology vertical in looking at clean technologies and how they can be applied. And I know Google has some significant interest in all these companies as well, and in this area as well. So in terms of specific companies for us, I'm an investor in a company called Cicato, X-I-C-A-T-O. It's an LED module company. It's shipped over 600,000 LED modules and is producing the very best LED light that is out there. There is no question, for those who might doubt it, that the LED conversion will happen. If you go to a lighting show today, you will not be able to find any other light source in any meaningful numbers other than LEDs. That's all manufacturers are showing. That's all they're going to do. So we have a lot of, I feel like this management team, which has done a great job, and we're looking forward to a very bright future for them as well.
And what is driving the LED market?
Well, the paybacks at less than 2 years, along with the equivalency of being equivalent to halogen light, is the two factors, together with the fact that you don't have to replace an LED bulb, so to speak, bulb, for 10 years or more. And as a result, especially in commercial settings, you end up lowering your maintenance costs quite a bit. So all those factors have played into LED's rapid expansion, especially in Europe. It really hasn't taken off in this country yet, but Europe is quickly converting.
Great. Now, Nancy Klein of the City of San Jose, can you give us a breakdown on the key clean tech sectors that are growing in the South Bay? We talked previously and you mentioned manufacturing as a strong area. Can you give us a few examples of companies that are manufacturing here in the Bay Area?
Manufacturing is very, very exciting here, and people think that manufacturing has left the United States. But when you talk about innovation, commercialization, and it really is a hub around new product introduction, and when you think about that even a little bit deeper, it's where a manufacturer, a contract manufacturer particularly, will take a low volume but very high mix of products. So a ton of companies, in fact, the 10, which are the largest in the world, where they call them tier one contract manufacturers, are all here in Silicon Valley. Six of them are in San Jose. So they're like a secret weapon resource. And what we try to do is very much link baby investors to those companies. Often venture capital have special relationships with one or two of those contract manufacturers, because you take someone with a really hot idea, and then you put them with all of the accelerated services that somebody like a Flextronics or a Jabil or a Celestica, a Sanmina can do for you, and you have, if the product is good, if the idea is good, you can have a rocket in terms of acceleration. And there are a ton of companies here that also interface with the semiconductor industry. So you're putting out products in healthcare that are very interesting, that are also clean and green. You're putting out products that are in efficiency. You're putting out in manufacturing systems. And just to name a slew of companies that might be great for job opportunities, Flextronics just moved to San Jose. I'm also doing a slight commercial, and Sun Power, which is outside of manufacturing, but they have all of their office R&D and pilot lines in San Jose. Maxim, which is very much in the integrated systems and chips. Valen, which is a fantastic company which does measurement and control systems for manufacturing, filtration, other types of automation. And we're very proud of a deep legacy of solar in the city with Solar Junction, Sun Power, Soul Focus, Nano Solar. We also are very proud on the lighting side to be affiliated with companies like Enlighted, Lunera, Switch, and Philips Lumileds, all which there's a couple of those companies that aren't in San Jose, and we really highlight not just the city, but the ecosystem that Silicon Valley is. So there is a ton. I also want to throw in there companies in clean transportation, like Kaloom, if you're not familiar, charging station developer, fantastic, and also building systems like Echelon or Cypress Environmental. So that's just a small smattering, and those folks are all hiring.
Great. Good news from Nancy. So Parag Chokshi, I'd love you to talk about Google's investments in clean tech startups. There must be entrepreneurs in the audience saying, I would just love Google to invest in my clean tech startup. Can you talk about the startups that Google has invested in and their investment rationale?
Sure. So I would say our investments are in two categories. There's the project investments we've done, which I touched on before, which is done out of Google's cash. And then there are venture-style investments that we're doing through Google Ventures. So Google Ventures doesn't have a specific focus on clean tech, but they have invested in several clean tech companies. A couple of companies, there's a really interesting company called Transform, which is trying to reduce the efficiency losses in electronics. There's another company called Cool Planet Biofuels that have developed some really interesting technology on creating biofuels more efficiently and negative carbon electricity. I think in terms of our venture investments, it's a lot of the same criteria that you'd see for any venture fund. We're just looking. I mean, Google is interested in innovation and innovative sort of world changing ideas as a company, and so those are the kinds of projects and companies we try to support, both from a venture's perspective and from our project investing. It's lending our capital to something that can really transform the sector. And on the project investing side, where I've done more work, you see that in a lot of the projects. Solar City, we've invested in.
Thank you very much.
One of our largest investments. We've done a $280 million fund, or the Atlantic Wind Connection, which is another great example of a transformative project to build a 350-mile transmission line off the East Coast that individual offshore wind farms could plug into. It's a challenging project, a long-term project, but something that we think could be transformational. So those are the kinds.
Can you give us some more detail on that investment in Solar City? Why did you choose Solar City?
Sure. Solar City is growing really quickly. They've developed a great model, it's really a way to scale. Distributed generation is in many places around the country is already competitive, and especially when you're talking about retail electricity rates. Here's an example of the proposition for a customer, a Solar City customer, and you can speak more to this than I can, but you can pay less than you're paying right now and use clean energy. So we find that really compelling. Helping homeowners go solar was something that aligned with our values, and it made a lot of sense.
Right. And can you talk, Parag, about what Google is doing internally? I understand you have one of the largest, if not the largest, free electric charging station infrastructure to encourage all your employees to drive green EV cars. And you've been on the forefront of making your data centers more energy efficient. Can you talk about how Google is driving this whole internal adoption of clean and green efficient uses?
Sure. Yeah, we've done a lot of work. One of the other areas I said, in terms of spurring innovation, spurring growth in the sector, we've done a lot of investing, and we're also piloting technologies on our campus. I would say that's the other big thing that we're doing. There are a lot of components to that. Our data centers that you mentioned, we use about half as much energy as the industry average at our data centers. You have to look at the incentives. It's about being green and also saving money. The practices that we've put in place at our data centers have saved Google $1 billion over the last 10 years. So it's real money, we're excited about some of the newest technologies that we have in place there. We're also piloting new technologies, as you mentioned. We have the largest corporate EV charging infrastructure at our campus. It's interesting to take a little bit of a step back and looking at our transportation programs as a whole. One of the reasons that we have EV chargers on campus is because we have a shuttle fleet. That shuttle fleet transports over 4,000 employees to Mountain View. It's a biofuel-powered bus fleet. It enhances productivity of our employees. They're not sitting in traffic. It's got Wi-Fi, so you can work on the bus.
They're working on the bus.
And it takes about 3,000 cars off the road, the equivalent of 3,000 cars off the road. And we developed this EV charging infrastructure really to develop a fleet of cars that our employees could use if they need to do errands around campus. So if you look at this as holistically, it's saving Google money, and it's encouraging clean transportation. So we try to think long term, and we try to sort of look at the whole picture when we're piloting technologies on our campus.
Great. And Linda, can you take us inside SolarCity? You're head of HR. Can you describe to the audience what are the main jobs that are available today?
Like I mentioned, we're in, I think, 13 states, so it depends somewhat state by state what kind of jobs that we have available. At our HQ office, which is here in San Mateo, you'd have a lot of the typical sort of corporate functions there, where we have the finance and the legal teams and folks like that. We have our software engineering team there. We also have our PV development team there. And then there's jobs in all of those areas in the company.
How many openings do you have right now in the Bay Area?
Kia Walker's through the Director of Talent Acquisitions here, so she knows a number better than me. What is it, Kia? Yeah.
About
300.
About 300 openings.
That's across the company. So those 300 positions that we have open now really span across the company. We have a lot of installation positions, as you can imagine, out in our field operations. We actually have a VP position available in Hawaii. If anyone's interested in going to Hawaii, let us know. So it's kind of a broad spectrum of positions, and some that maybe you don't think typically of a company that's in the solar energy business. Like
Linda, can you move your mic a bit closer? We're having sound issues. There we go.
I have a big mouth. Usually you can hear me without the microphone. So I forgot where I was going. But anyway, we have positions across the company and in pretty much any area that you can think of, and not things that you just think about solar for. Like I said, we have engineering, software engineers, accounting folks, customer care, all kinds of positions like that.
Right. Sounds a broad spectrum of opportunities available. And we talked earlier, Linda, about some stories. I asked each of the panelists to share a story with me of an inspiring story about someone who perhaps last year was in an audience like this looking for a job or looking to transfer. And Linda, you had a great story for me about how you recruited someone. Can you share that with us?
Actually, you know, I'm responsible for the HR function in the company, and part of that is recruiting and everything. So I take that part of my job really passionately. And so I'm constantly recruiting. I was actually at dinner in San Francisco with a couple other members of my team. We were having dinner, and we had this really great waiter. I mean, he had this great energy and this great look and this great customer service and all that. And he kept coming back to the table and, you know, chit-chat, have a little conversation here and there and everything. I said, so this is what you do at night. You're a waiter at night. I said, what's your day job? He said, well, I just finished school, and I'm not quite sure what I want to do. And I said, great. I said, come and talk to us at SolarCity, because he sort of embodies the spirit of the people that we're looking for, right? I mean, he really did a great job. He was passionate about the job he did. He provided this phenomenal customer service and, you know, with a big smile on his face, and he just had this great energy and all that. He's hired now as one of our inside solar advisors, where folks like everyone here in the audience will call up and show interest in SolarCity, and he'll work to qualify and see if, you know, you're, you know, a good candidate for solar and all that. And he's loving it, you know. He really loves it there. The other example I think I might have talked to you about, and Josh mentioned, he remembered the US Web days. I was one of the early on employees there. And Toby Corey was one of the founders of US Web, and he did very well cashing out his stock options at US Web back in the day and all that. But he hadn't really been in a work environment for a number of years, like a big corporate environment and all that. And he was kind of toying with, what do I want to do next and all that. And he doesn't, I'm probably not giving anything away that he probably wouldn't let you know anyway, but he doesn't have to work. I mean, he's financially secure and all that. He doesn't need to work. But he's now working at SolarCity. He's our chief revenue officer. And the reason that he came to SolarCity is he's so passionate about what we do and how we do it and the people. And he met the founders and shared their vision. He's really passionate about the planet and the earth. He's on the Wildlife Direct board with Dr. Richard Leakey and all that. So he has a passion for this space. So for someone like that to, I call it, come out of retirement when you don't have to, you know, is, I think, another great story. And I got credit for recruiting him, too. So anyway.
And Linda, you're probably best qualified to answer the question. Do you have any tips or advice for people in the audience and those listening at home mm-hmm. who are thinking of changing careers or getting into this yeah. clean tech space straight out of college?
How many people currently have jobs in the clean tech space? Okay, a few. How many want a job in the clean tech space? Ooh, a lot more. Okay, I'll give you some of my tips. What I look for in people is the type of person that Nick was, the waiter in the restaurant that just had this great personality about him, right, where I could see that he would fit into the culture of our company. So it has to be people that just have a passion for life. They're, you know, happy, upbeat people, can provide great customer service. You don't have to have a background in green technology. I didn't. I come from the Silicon Valley high-tech world and all that. I think the most important thing that you can do to get yourself at least recognized where we get lots of resumes and all that is differentiate yourself. Tell us what it is about our company and the job that you've looked at and maybe found on the website. What is it about that job that got you inspired or made you think, okay, I want to pick up the phone or send an email and send my resume in? Tell us why you think that you're the best candidate and what resonated for you about the company or about the job and all that. Key is going to cringe when I say this, but I love getting handwritten letters or hand-typed letters from people. In this day and age of technology where everything's internet and resumes come flying in and all that, I love getting that very personalized message from somebody that tells me, this is who I am. This is what I think I can bring to the company. I've looked at this position online, and I think I'm best suited for it because. And I love that. I love getting those letters. Sometimes I get them in, you know, little pink envelopes. I get them in FedEx. I get, you know, all kinds of different ways. And I really do love that. That's that personal touch. I'm not saying you all have to write me a letter or anything like that. But I do love that personalization in this somewhat impersonal world of ours. But really telling us about what it is you think you can bring to the company and what's interested you about the company usually, you know, touches a spot in our hearts. And we take a real close look at those kinds of resumes and letters from folks.
Great advice, Linda. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Josh, we talked earlier about a commencement speech you made at UCLA. Can you share that advice?
I mean, I gave this commencement speech about 11 years ago, and I encouraged the graduates then to create both a compass in one hand and a scale in the other. The compass was to be their passion, just like Linda was talking about, as well as this, and the scale was to be balance. And balancing all things in life that they went through with family, fun, fulfillment, putting all those things together into a basket and into a scale. But the compass, as it relates really to clean technology, is the passion. It's the passion to really change the world. The reason I decided to do this in 2006 is I'd spent so long in the Valley that I was able to compare it to my days in the early 1980s. When people were truly taking metric-based technology, true innovation, and deciding whether or not to change the world or not with that. And I compared it against the late 90s, which was a go-go time around here with all the dot-coms and all the rest of it, many of which produced no lasting value. And I wanted to test it to see which was clean tech. Was it real technology with real meritorious-based change? Or was it similar to the dot-com? After 6 months of doing that, I actually decided to do it on the basis that, and you may know this individual, Henry Kravis, who's the head of KKR, had just done the largest leverage buyout in U.S. history of a Texas utility called TXU. And they still own it to this day. And he says, how is it that you're buying TXU when you plan to close 9 of the 11 coal plants that the company has today, currently? And he says, because this clean technology is going to change the world. And when a leverage buyout guy starts talking about technology, I knew that technology really had value that just needed to be unlocked. So for me personally, that's how I made my decision to come into here, into this area, is that I really analogized it to the early 80s, right here in the blocks around downtown San Jose. And I haven't been disappointed to this point.
And Nancy Klein, can you talk to the entrepreneurs in the audience? How can entrepreneurs get assistance from the City of San Jose and your partners?
Sure. And before I do that, I just want to add in on resources and knowing your resources. For example, for the folks who raise their hand who might want to have a job in clean tech, it's taking advantage of the networks here that you can tap into. Some of them I'll mention that you're probably familiar with but maybe haven't considered stepping into. For example, Clean Tech Open, if you're not familiar with them, they're an incredible – it's a business plan phenomena, but at the same time, it's a huge gathering of people who help companies, and they use a lot of volunteers. So that's a great way to meet a lot of baby companies and a lot of big companies that are investing. Solar Tech, which is an association of many, many organizations, Solar City is a part of, cuts across the spectrum of folks who are in solar and financing, and also an organization that leverages a good deal of companies and resources across a broad spectrum. And then our own city resources, something called Work to Future. We serve about 200, 250,000 people a year. It's free to anyone. It doesn't have to be that you're in San Jose. And it's really job services. If you're underemployed or you want to get yourself videoed on how to interview or job training skills and access to incredible database systems to give you a heads up about what industries are hiring. So I would just remind you that there are networks of people here that you can take advantage of and broaden your job opportunities in a lot of different ways. And then in terms of entrepreneurial assistance, the city runs a number of different programs that work through the Entrepreneur Center, which is in downtown San Jose, where there are a tremendous number of assets to be able to look at an entrepreneur's business and look at market data, look at are you running your systems, are you looking at where you're networking, and those services are all for free. There's also an opportunity called Business Owner Space, which is a gathering of 40 different services that help companies that look at how they could fund you. Opportunity Fund, which is something that Eric Weaver, if you know him, they invest funds from California Redevelopment, which is the little R that banks still are very much putting their money into. So there are really good resources with really great assistance programs, technical skills, loan access that I would highly recommend you find out a little bit more. You can easily learn about those on our website, which is sjeconomy.com.
Great. Thank you, Nancy. So, Parag, for those in the audience wanting to join Google's green team, can you talk about being in the green team, what qualities are common to people in the green team? And I checked last night online, there actually are 7 openings for various sustainability positions, green positions within Google. Can you talk on that, please?
Sure, yeah. I mean, we are expanding. We have positions open across a lot of different functions. And we really, you know, Google is a very non-hierarchical place. So we have teams within a lot of different areas doing green work. And we haven't, you know, we sort of informally come together. And so there are many positions available. And I think, you know, applying to Google and for a green job, you know, there are a lot of qualities that Google looks for in general, which is just highly collaborative, you know, being able to be a self-starter and to work really independently and drive forward a project. But the other thing that I think is very important for Google is looking at creative solutions, thinking about creative solutions. You know, we really value innovation and creativity in what we're doing, and it's driven a lot of the programs and initiatives that we have. So, you know, like Linda was saying before, you know, it's always better and more interesting when you've got a really great idea or a new way of thinking about something, and highlighting that in your passion. You know, you're passionate about this. You've thought it through. You have, and even if it's something that we may have already done, it shows that you're thinking about new ways of doing things, and that's really valuable.
Great. Now, we've got some questions from the audience. The first, I think, we'll address to Josh. Can you give us your thoughts on energy storage and interesting companies in the storage space?
Well, I'll give you my generalized thoughts on energy storage. I mean, I think it's the most important development that could happen for our grid at the utility scale storage level, as well as in the emerging EV market. It will be the most important development to encourage the widespread adoption of electric vehicles. And first on the grid side, we have a system, because there is no storage, that would never be tolerated in any other part of our economy. And that is, the second you produce an electron, it has to be consumed. And it just goes down the transmission lines, and it must be consumed. And when you need more, you gotta produce more. And this results in quite uneconomic things, like creation of peaker plants that are used for 5 to 15 hours a year, and that's the only time that those plants are ever used. Usually about this time of the year, actually in August. And so storage there has the greatest potential to unlock value of almost any technological development that's in existence. As well, in the transportation sector, lithium-ion batteries, though they are, without question, the lightest batteries that are able to be used, they still weigh in the new Tesla and the Model S, I believe it's about 1,400 pounds. I'm not sure, but it's about that number. Yeah, and that's way too much. To the extent that you can get those to be a much smaller battery packs and the rest, you can unlock incredible advantages for those.
Plus the cost aspect.
The cost as well. So where is that going? Well, I believe firmly for the next 10 years that lithium and lithium ion technologies are going to be where battery and storage are focused. And for both applications, by the way, although it's a little more challenging on the grid side, but for other reasons than just weight, on the grid utility scale side, lithium ion technologies are very interesting. There are a number of companies in this area. There are probably, I'm just guessing right now, but probably 50 to 60 venture-backed companies inside the Bay Area that are focused on advanced battery technologies. It would be unwise for me to pick any real winners out of that. And in fact, we've been challenged in finding an investment that we really could get behind. But one company we did decide to invest in is a company that is extracting lithium out of geothermal brine. And what it does is it takes, as geothermal brine comes up, it delivers a bunch of mud to the that is ultimately turned into steam for the generation of the geothermal plant. And as that mud goes through the plant, it's then going to go back down into the earth. But in it, in the Salton Sea in Southern California, it has large deposits of lithium in it. And as a result, we take that out before it goes down those pipes and process it through our factory and extract the lithium. We also extract manganese and zinc. But we do that as the world's lowest cost lithium producer in the world, lower than Chile, Argentina, and China. We also do it with the best environmental footprint. We don't use water. We don't use added electricity to heat things up. We don't have to use nearly the other elements that the other manufacturers do. So we as a firm, Moore Davidow, has decided to invest in the production of lithium, because we do believe that this is going to be a technology that's here to stay for at least the next 10 to 15 years, and will help fuel this the storage revolution.
Great. Now we have a question for Nancy. Is Silicon Valley doing enough to be the leader in green tech, or are we falling behind other cities and countries?
That's a great question. I think we're doing a lot. I think we capitalize on the notion that we have early adapters and adopters here that make it very feasible. I think the state, even though we're struggling so with the legislation that's passing, very much now the cap and trade considerations will be very powerful. And if we can get cap and trade passed, then that will turn, the estimates are conservatively somewhere between $1 billion and $4.5 billion on an annual basis back into investment in clean tech and reduction in carb. So that's a huge advantage, AB 118 in clean transportation. So I think we're doing a lot, but clearly other nations like China, other areas in Europe that are expending a lot more, putting their money where their mouths are, is very powerful. So we have to be very careful.
What more would you do if you had unlimited resources at the city of San Jose? What would you do, knowing what you know about clean tech and what it needs?
Some of the things we focus on, of course, are buildings and building efficiency, because that takes so much of energy in our world. And we would love to see programs which was previously known as PACE, but basically taking the investment of your efficiency infrastructure and making it sort of like a home mortgage so that it runs with the property. And if you applied that to scale on an industrial basis as well as to housing, that would be an innovation in the finance side that would open up a lot of windows in terms of scale for companies who are doing that kind of business, and also in clean transportation. That's the other side of that so much of the taking out the diesel, taking out so much of the gasoline, that we would bring the cost differential. Josh was talking about investments that would get to renewables like we've gotten to fossil fuels, that if we could do those two things, we'd have our 50 million square feet of buildings in the city, and you'd have a – because we're not building as much now because of the economy, but if you could really impact what exists and what's running around in between buildings, we would be skyrocketing.
All right, great.
And I should just add that this is one of the most important investment categories for us in terms of looking forward, is buildings as well. We think that there's tremendous value to be unlocked through the application of technology to what have really not been very smart, you know, buildings up to this point, although Google's probably doing the best job at that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that segues nicely into an audience question for Parag and Linda. Does Google or SolarCity have any ongoing programs to promote green energy conservation in houses and in offices?
We do have. We've done some work. I think energy information, access to information, energy, IT infrastructure in buildings is usually important. We've done some work. We had a product called Power Meter that we had developed that was just a beta sort of program, but it allowed people to get a window into their energy use, and it wasn't real time, and there's still some challenges to getting real time information about your energy use. But a lot of studies show that just having access to the information alone, will lead to 10-15% savings. We've done some work there, and at our office spaces, we're doing a lot of work on green buildings. Everything from just natural lighting to free cooling at our data centers.
What do you mean by free cooling? Can you explain what that means?
Sure. Most data centers will use industrial chillers, basically industrial air conditioners, to cool servers. And what we've done is using evaporative cooling, you can achieve a lot of the same cooling results without the use of carbon-intensive air conditioning units. So in our data center in Finland is a great example. It's on the Bay of Finland. We use seawater. It's actually in an old paper mill. So it was a creative solution to site a data center there. And the piping was already in place. And we pump seawater in. It cools our servers. And then it's pushed back out. So it's a closed-loop system. It comes in, it goes back out. And obviously we make sure that we're not changing the temperature of the bay when we do that. But it's an innovative way of both reducing our energy costs and doing it more in a more environmentally friendly way. We've also done a lot in our buildings. it just runs the gamut, but very simple solutions. I think there's a lot of low hanging fruit. Everything from one great example is carpet tiles. We've done a lot. All of our buildings have tiled carpets, so if there's a spill, you don't have to replace the entire sort of carpet. You just take that piece and replace it. So a lot of solutions like that are actually pretty simple, pretty cost effective, and can really improve building efficiency.
Great. And Linda, can you talk about SolarCity?
Yeah, we're not obviously as big as Google, and we don't own our own building, so we're a bit at the mercy of our landlord and all that. But when we moved into the space that we're in now, which was about 9 months ago, we made sure that when they were retrofitting, the buildings that we're in actually were built in the 1970s, so they were not at all efficient. So they went in and gutted the building, and we did the most we could do within the guidelines that would work for the building and with our landlord and all that. But like Parag was talking about is the carpet tiles on the floor. You take one out and you don't have to clean the whole carpet, things like that. All of our cubicles in our building are all from recycled materials, very energy efficiency lighting and all that. One of the things that's really cool for us too is our employees are obviously very passionate about the environment and what we do as a company and how we contribute. And we have a lot of employees that drive from San Francisco or ride their bikes. They do ride they ride down from San Francisco. I don't know how they do it. But anyway, they ride their bikes from San Francisco. We have the buses, like Barack was talking about, where we bus in our employees and all that. But some of the other cool things that we do is, like, we're constantly thinking about, everything that we do that we contribute, we think about what are we printing on the printer. We do everything like double-sided printing, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in the course of the year, you'd be amazed at how much paper you can save, right? We have in our lunchrooms and our cafeterias, we have three bins for like trash and compost and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, you put stuff in the wrong thing, man. People go crazy. It's like, oh, what are you doing? You can put that in there. That can go in compost and some of that. So it's nice to see that we sort of live by, the values that we have for our company and what we're trying to do and helping the planet and all that kind of stuff.
And are you also educating homeowners when you're putting solar panels on? Are you educating them about saving energy?
Absolutely. We also, in addition to the solar part of our business and all that, we actually have an energy efficiency component to our business and electrical vehicle charging stations and all that that we'll install. So it's not that we just do one thing. I mean, we cover a broad spectrum of things, and we'll come into your house and do a whole energy efficiency audit on your house and look at, your ducts leaking. Do you need to seal around your windows? Do you need to install a new efficient hot water heater and things like that? And we'll do that for you.
Great. Now, here's another question from the audience. We have an election coming up. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the presidential candidates, Romney and President Obama, in terms of clean and green tech development? Josh, would you like to tackle that? Loaded question.
This is being recorded, right?
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what I was afraid of. It's been a struggle. I mean, that's the bottom line. I think that President Obama has his heart in the right place, without question. I was privileged early in the administration to meet with Carol Browner and talk about all the plans that the president had for energy legislation and for environmental legislation and the like. Unfortunately, much of the political capital was used on the healthcare debate. And that left little for any real meaningful progress to be made over these past 4 years on that. However, the voice of the president has never been stronger about a clean energy economy, and his support for it has been unwavering. And the problem with clean energy is it gets into a political football. The truth is, I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but cap and trade was a Republican proposal, okay? And it was proposed by the Republican Party. But once we get into all the politics that are associated – and by the way, the loan guarantee program was proposed under George Bush's 2007 energy policy that he got adopted. So as a result, but unfortunately, because President Obama has come out so much in favor of clean energy, that forces the Republicans into the opposite camp. And as a result, you see a lot of I'll call it skepticism among Republicans about that. That's really unfortunate and the rest. I've seen two different versions of Mitt Romney's energy plan. Neither one of them are, I would say, as robust as our current president has in terms of energy plans and the rest. And I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Nancy, do you have an opinion you'd like to share?
There's been a lot out of the current administration that is attempting to link with cities, in particular recognizing that cities often are the first place of innovation because in relative terms we have the least amount of bureaucracy. So that I think would be tough to beat by a different administration. And I know the stimulus practices or conversations are very, very conservative, but the amount of dollars that went out to stimulate clean tech very impressive, and a lot of good was done out of it. So I think or hope that those efforts would continue, whichever party, because the ideas that come to be. But it's a question when you align yourself on the other side, how do you move back, at least in the first couple of years of your administration?
One thing I just do want to give a plug for one government program, that is ARPA-E.
Oh, yeah.
ARPA-E is an investment in research and development and energy projects. It's under the Department of Energy. And so far, so good, it's escaped the political football and has been authorized. It was first authorized under the Bush administration, but not funded. So there was no money for it. Under the stimulus program, and that's what reminded me of this, is that it's now funded. And now in the regular budget, it's been funded as well for another year. And in the upcoming budget, it also seems to be getting bipartisan support for its funding.
And Josh would also speak to, you know, it's the son of or daughter of DARPA, yeah, which really funded so much in this country. It was the idea to resurrect that idea. It's a sort of a moonshot for this type of clean tech.
It was a response to the Sputnik.
Yes.
Russians beating us at innovation. And in fact, I read yesterday that ARPA, Advanced Research Project Agency, doled out $43 million in research funding just this month, and most of it on battery technology. So the energy storage is a key thing. So we have reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question. So to wrap up tonight's discussion on the green economy, I'd like your very brief answers on the following question. Are you bullish or bearish on the future of the green economy and why? And let's start here with Josh.
I'm bullish because technology will unlock value that will change the current production and use of energy in this country and around the world. And technology is poised to do that. It, just like it has done it in the information technology sector, it is going to do that in the clean energy sector as well. I have no doubts about that. That is going to happen. And the countries and the societies and the cities and the communities that can get behind that the soonest and the most aggressively are going to be the winners over the long term.
Nancy Klein of the City of San Jose.
Two pieces of a great question. One is the spirit of the entrepreneurs in this area are incredible. And the serial entrepreneurs who are taking their dollars when they don't necessarily have to and working on convergence, bringing together different sectors to create products and clean tech, which many times you need. No, it's not simple often to create the idea or chemistry of a clean tech product. And I also would say the young people across the country, but certainly in our area, that just have a passion for the environment in a way that maybe, you know, even our generation didn't have. So very bullish and look forward to more coming despite whatever else is going on.
Parag Chokshi of Google.
Unsurprisingly, I'm also very bullish. I think this is one of the biggest challenges of our time, and I think that we'll rise to the challenge, and not just in terms of climate change, but, you know, if you look around the world, there are almost 1 billion people who don't have access to energy, and I think that there's a hunger, and there's a lot of growth in the developing world, and I think that we'll see new and clean solutions to that problem.
Great. And finally, Linda Kiala of Solar City.
I guess you already know my answer, which is very bullish. I think for me, almost on a personal level, it's like I don't know how we continue to produce and consume energy the way we do today. And we have to look to the future and see where green technology is going to take us, right? We will destroy the planet and wreak havoc on the earth if we don't change the way that we do things. So I'm very bullish. very happy to be at SolarCity and hopefully making a difference.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank the panel, and I'd like to pass the closing to Brian Gonger of Deloitte.
Thank you, Allison. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this evening with the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. And special thanks to Linda and Parag and Nancy and Josh and particularly Allison. And with that, to our audience here and to our audience in radio and television, this meeting is adjourned. Good night.